He was the head of the chemical services unit from 1995 to 2000. He was the head of the Department of Chemical Physics, and 2008 to 2010, he's the chair of the Scientific Council of the Institute. At present, he's the head of the Nancy and Stephen Grant Center for Sensors and Security, and the incumbent of the Araya and Mincy Katzman Professorial Chair of the Institute. Now, Ron has received many honors and awards during his career. So just to name a few here, Fellow of the American Physical Society, 2007, he got the Lectureship Award from the Division of Colloid and Surface Chemistry of the Chemical Society of Japan. In 2011, he received the Erasmus Mundus Research Scholarship at the Technical University Dresden. The same year, he got a Research Excellence Prize from the Israel Vacuum Society. And very recently, 2013, he was honored with a Fest Shift in the Journal of Physical Chemistry C. Okay, so now there are two striking qualities about Ron that I must say. One is that he has a remarkable ability to translate fundamental research in his lab to very applied sciences, actually. So he has 10 patents. Is this up to date?
It's more
than 10 patents. And his inventions have helped launch a startup company which caters to the semiconductor manufacturing sector in Israel. He developed a pocket sensor device which detects nitric monoxide, and this is currently in use, I believe, detecting imminence of asthma attack in patients. Truly diverse applications, really. The second striking quality about Ron is how encouraging he is towards young scientists and, you know, students. You must have felt that. Every time, I know him since I've been a postdoc at Duke, and every time I talk to him, I come back, you know, feeling charged and highly motivated. So this visit is no exception, and we certainly want to thank him for the time he's taken to interact with students here at TIFR. Okay, so today's talk, Ron will be talking about molecular spintronics. So this talk is very timely. He's going to talk about a new discovery in his lab, the ability of molecules to act as spin filters. Last week we heard from Stuart Parkin, IBM, on how about spintronics using magnetic materials, and Ron will be telling us how molecules can do the same. So I invite Ron to tell us more about this fascinating subject and its implications for technology and biology.
Thank you very much. Perhaps we can turn off the light here. It will make it easier. Okay. First of all, thank you for the hospitality. You know, I feel here like home, far from home, because as some of you know already, and I hope the other will find, TIFR and the Weizmann are really very similar in their spirit, and we are really happy to have this contact with TIFR, which is going now for a while, and I hope it will strengthen. So it's really very nice feeling being here and meeting friends, old friends, new friends, and the young students. So I'm going to tell you about an effect which we call chiral-induced spin selectivity effect, KISS effect, and its application. And let's start with a question. Let's assume that you have the task to design a system that will transfer electron in an efficient way on molecular scale. As chemists, at least, we would use conjugated molecules. Physicists will use wires that are similar in a sense. It's quite amazing to realize that nature didn't choose this way. Nature went for proteins. Now, at first glance, proteins are saturated hydrocarbons, and we would think that they will be extremely inefficient for electron transfer. However, nature is using proteins, and electron transfer through these proteins, as I will show, is very efficient. So what is the secret of the proteins? And I'm going to show you perhaps an answer. We are not 100% sure that this is the answer, but we may allude to the answer. And to understand what's going on with proteins, let's think about the rifle effect. And that's macroscopic world, and I'm using rifle as an example, not because I'm coming from the Middle East, but because because it's really an interesting effect. So what is rifle? for those of you that don't know what is the difference between gun and rifle, rifle is a gun with grooves. Namely, the bullet, when it's going through the gun, gets some angular momentum, and when the bullet leaves, it leaves rotating. So what we have in the rifle, we have coupling of angular and linear momentum. And that's classical physics, and the reason it makes such an efficient system is because when we have to conserve both angular momentum and linear momentum, the collisions with the air are not efficient. So it's quite surprising, if you think about it, that something that rotates, in addition to moving forwards, actually has less friction than something that's going simply forwards. But that's known from the 19th century, actually. So the question is, can we use this concept on a molecular scale? And what I'm going to show you, that we can do it, and we will do it by coupling spin to linear momentum of electrons, the electron spin to its linear momentum, via chiral molecules. So the question is, how chiral molecules and spin are related? Actually, some of the students asked me about it today. And so let's think about it a little bit. Spin, as you know, is a magnetic moment, spin of an electron. And so we have a magnetic dipole moment. Now, what happens with chiral molecules? We think we know a lot about chiral molecules, but one thing I want to tell you, which is sort of trivial, but we never think about it. If we take Maxwell's equation and we think about electron moving, we know that the magnetic field of the electron moving is perpendicular to its direction of propagation, right? It propagates this way, and the magnetic field is perpendicular to it. When electron is going through chiral object, and it can be a coil, macroscopic coil, we get magnetic field which is either parallel or anti-parallel to the direction of propagation of the electron. Now, how it happens? The reason is because in a chiral object, the velocity of the electron is almost perpendicular to its direction of propagation. So if you think about a coil, think about a coil. That's a simple macroscopic coil. The current is going this way, but it propagates this way. So we get a field, magnetic field, in the inside the coil that points either parallel or anti-parallel to the direction of propagation, depending on the handedness of the coil. So now, therefore, if electron is moving through chiral molecules, we expect to have magnetic field, and this magnetic field can interact with the magnetic dipole of the spin, and here we have a way to couple spin with linear momentum. Actually, things are more complicated, and I will go into it later. So first of all, what I'm going to show you are several examples of the effect, several tools we developed for measuring the effect, devices we made based on this effect. Then I will go through some theory and explain you how we see the effect from where it comes, the microscopic insight of it. And finally, I will end with spins, the importance of spin in real biological system and other important chemical system. So the first experiment I want to describe to you is the following experiment. We took nickel substrate, which is magnet. We put on it double-strand DNA. I will not go into the all details. The paper was published in Nanoletter quite long ago. Then we attach gold nanoparticle to the top of the DNA. Now we came with the tip of a conductive AFM, and we measure the current that's going from the nickel through the DNA, through the gold, to the tip as a function of the magnetization of the nickel. When the nickel is magnetized either this way or opposite way, it means that we can inject spins pointing along the velocity or anti-parallel to the velocity of the electrons. So those of you that do or did AFM experiment, you know that AFM or STM, data analysis is the tricky business. So we decided to do something very simple. We don't do any analysis. What you see here are the results of hundreds of measurements through hundreds of different molecules. When the magnet is pointing one direction, down or up, and these are IV curves, the numbers here refer to the length of the DNA, number of base pairs. So you see here 26, 40, 50 base pairs. As a reference, we have gold substrate in which we don't eject spin, and therefore we do expect to have the same results for spin up and spin down. So even without any analysis, you realize immediately that in this case, the current we see is higher than in this case. And then we do average, and sure enough, we see that for the two spins, one in blue and one in red, we get very different IV curves, and you see a huge spin selectivity here. For example, in here, you see factor larger than 10 in the current of one spin versus the other. This is the density of states, the IDV, and you get the density of that. Of course, on the control, you see that the results are identical. So based on this, we can calculate the spin, the state of the different spins, and we see as function of the length of the DNA, and we see different barrier for transmission, that's the barrier height. And as you realize immediately, the barrier height here, the difference in the barriers, is about 1 EV. Now, this is an enormous number. For you to feel a little bit, the spin orbit coupling of carbon, it's about 3 millielectron volt. In the spin orbit coupling in hydrocarbon is 100 micro electron volt. Here we see electron volt. How can it be? Okay, remember the question. Here is results that my postdoc Kiran did. As you see, he's from India, as you can recognize. And he did fantastic work on proteins, oligopeptides, actually. And in the oligopeptides, we see also very clear difference between the two spin state. Here, the difference in the barrier, it's about 0.5 EV. And the question is, what's going on here? But before answering what's going on, we can, even without knowing what's going on, we can use these findings to make devices. And I want to describe to you two types of spintronics devices that are based on the same, on the concept I just suggested. So here you see the regular spintronic device. It's a basically spin valve. That's what you saw probably in the talk that Ravi mentioned. So it's known that you take two ferromagnets, and if the two ferromagnets are magnetized parallel to each other, you get low resistance. If they are magnetized anti-parallel to each other, you get high resistance. As a result, if you measure the resistance as a function of the magnetic field, you get a symmetric type curve, because the two magnets can be pointing up together or down together. So if you apply strong enough magnetic field, you can magnetize them both up or both down, and then you get low resistance. In between, one of them is pointing one direction, the other to the other direction, and therefore you get high resistance. So we decided to go and to make such a device based on our concept. Now, why? The reason is that typically in these devices, the common spintronic devices, the spin polarization at room temperature is very low. The spin polarization depends strongly on the temperature, and it's very difficult to scale down the device, to make it small, because once you make it small, the magnet becomes super paramagnetic instead of being ferromagnet, and therefore you can't keep it magnetized in one direction. So there are many technical problems in making these devices commercial on a nanoscale. So here is the device that we built. It was built by Shinto Matthew. He's a fantastic postdoc, and he built the device that looks like here. We have a gold. On top of it, we put our oligopeptides that we measured before, as I told you. On top of it, we put 2 nanometer of aluminum oxide. On top of it, we put nickel. So look what we have here. We have only one ferromagnet. We don't have permanent ferromagnet. We use gold, chiral molecules, and only one ferromagnet that will allow us to probe the spin that went through. And here are the results that we obtain. That's with the same alpha helix oligopeptide that I mentioned before. You realize for different temperature, you realize that now we don't get a symmetric curve as function of the magnetic field, but it's asymmetric. And the reason is because the spin going through the chiral molecules is always the same. So the nickel can be magnetized either so that it will allow the spin to go through or it will not allow. But we don't have a way to switch the chirality. So we get a spin valve that behaves, if you like a diode. Only one spin can go through. The other spin cannot go through. And we can take L and D cysteine, put on it aluminum oxide. So to our surprise, what we found, that this aluminum oxide, because it's thin and it's deposited on top of the cysteine, it's chiral. So the aluminum oxide become chiral. That was found by other groups also, but we used it in order to use it as a spin valve. And you see clearly that for the L-cysteine and D-cysteine, we get the opposite curves. And basically, it's not coming because of the cysteine, which is a very small a chiral molecule, but it's because of the chirality of the aluminum oxide. And we get it up in room temperature, and we can get up to 20% a magnetoresistance at room temperature, which is quite an enormous number. So that's one interesting device. Of course, immediately you ask, can we use it also for magnetic memory? And here let's think about magnetic memory. Magnetic memory is based again, the typical magnetic memory is based again on permanent ferromagnet, some non-magnetic spacer layer, and another ferromagnetic layer. When current is flowing through the ferromagnet to the other ferromagnet, it magnetizes this other ferromagnet. And when this ferromagnet is magnetized, of course, the resistivity is changing. Actually, here, because of the construction, the resistivity increases when this ferromagnet gets magnetized. What we built together with the group, yeah, please.
In the previous slide, I'm stuck at the previous slide of data. Why do you see changes in the D-cysteine and the L-cysteine percentage increase in the magnetic resistance, there was a little bit of a difference in the increase.
Okay. Right? So the reason is always that the monolayer of cysteine we make is different for L and D-cysteine. And we think the reason is that while L-cysteine, the source for L-cysteine is natural source, and there it's pure, therefore it's pure, that D-cysteine is never pure D. So you have some L. And as a result, the aluminum oxide that you form is not this exactly the same structure as the aluminum oxide you form on the pure L. So there is different behavior between L and D. And that's also known, you can see it by crystallography and other methods.
But ideally, you would have expected the same amount of magnetic resistance.
The magnetic resistance is basically very similar in amount. It varies, you know, it varies from one device to another, of course. Yes. Although Shinto succeeded to have 80% yield in production, but there's still variation within our experimental system because aluminum oxide deposition is a tricky business and so on. Okay, so let's go back to the memory. So we made a memory based on our Kiss effect. And now, of course, as you realize already, we don't need two magnets, so we have only one ferromagnetic layer. So when Carl is flowing from the metal through the chiral layer, we magnetize the ferromagnet, and when the ferromagnet gets magnetized, the resistance increases because now all the states that has this spin are occupied. So we get high resistance. This work was done together with a group of Yossi Paltiel from the Hebrew University. It was published in Nature Communication. And you realize here that when we pass current through the device, we get high resistance. We can switch magnetization up and down, and we can use it as a memory device. It works very, very nicely.
Why is it so slow?
The reason it's slow, because the ferromagnetic layer, it's actually not a full layer. The nickel, it's not really a smooth nickel. It's a thin nickel, so we have domains. So what happens, we magnetize each domain separately. So the time scale you see is the time scale for magnetizing all the domains.
So if you make a small device, it's faster.
Right, exactly. So you make small device, you can make it much faster. Exactly, that's exactly the issue. And in the meantime, now there's another paper that was accepted in NanoLetter just this week, in which you see that it's happening extremely fast when we make it small. Okay, that's devices. Now, another technique we developed is spin-dependent electrochemistry. And the concept, this was done by Claudio Fontanesi, a visitor from Modena, Italy, and Deb Mishra and Prakash, both of them postdocs from India, and Hila, she's a postdoc from Israel. And basically the idea is the following. We take a nickel substrate, we put on the nickel substrate a film or self-assembled monolayer of chiral molecules, we put in the solution some redox couple, ferrocene for example, and now we look on the current flowing from the nickel into the solution and backwards as function of the magnetization of the nickel. So here it's again the oligopeptide that I mentioned before. Now we use three different lengths of the oligopeptides, and with the lengths we get different current, of course, as longer the oligopeptide, so less current is flowing through, and we get increasing in the spin selectivity. And what you see, the black points here are the spin polarization as a function of the length. And as comparison, I presented data obtained by the group of Helmut Zacharias in Münster. And they did this experiment on the same systems, but using photoemission. So they do photoemission from surface to the monolayer. They measure the spin of the electrons after they follow the photoemission. They follow the transmission through the monolayer, and they got the spin polarization measured by a MOT polarimeter. I will not go into details, but interestingly, our result and their results are basically identical. Actually, interesting enough, we found that in the oligopeptide, we get about 6.5% polarization per nanometer in this range, while for DNA, it's 2.7% polarization. We got in DNA very high absolute polarization because the DNA is much longer than the oligopeptide. But here are really amazing results because here we use Carl conductive polymer. You know, conductive polymers are very important in the OLED industry and so on. And you can make them Carl by substituting Carl groups on the polymer. So look what happened. If we put it on gold, when there is no spin selectivity, this is the CV we get. When we put it on the nickel, and so for one direction of the magnet, it's going up and it's going backwards. But the other direction of the magnet, the current is not going backwards. It never becomes negative here. It blocks completely the conduction in the opposite direction of one spin, only one spin. And here you can see the time dependent of the conduction, and you realize that in one direction, one spin is conducted more, and in the other direction, the other spin is conducted more. So as I mentioned, the spin that is polarized, that's going through the system, depends on the direction of the velocity. Going in one direction, one spin is polarized, going the opposite direction, the other spin polarized, and we get 54% spin polarization. It's a huge effect. As you see, it's a ratio of about 1 to 4 in the transmission. Now we get to the big question, how it works. So, you know, typically spin filtering is observed either if you have a ferromagnetic materials or you have material with extremely high spin orbit coupling. Actually, spin orbit coupling by itself is not going to help you in making spin filtering. And I apologize for the chemist, but for the physicists in the audience, in order to get spin filtering, you have to break time reversal. And time reversal can be broken only if you have magnetic field. So the question is, how can we get with Carl molecules a spin filtering? Okay, so I will go slowly through the mechanism. I'm not going to explain it completely, but I will try to give you a feeling what's going on here. So think about it. Basically, we have electron moving in these slides. I was with my grandchildren in the playground, and I realized that this slide really demonstrates nicely the transmission of chiral molecules. And so basically, what we have, electron is passing through helical shape potential. That's, of course, clear to us. Now, because there is no inversion symmetry, in the rest frame of the electron, there is a magnetic field that acts on the spin. So I want to explain to you, in order to get effective spin orbit coupling in conduction, you need to break inversion symmetry. And it's very easy to understand. For example, if you have field acting on the electron, if the electron going one direction, it's pushing it here. But if it's coming back and the force is working on the opposite direction, of course, it cancels itself. So if you have inversion symmetry, the effect is canceled. When you break inversion symmetry, you can have dramatic spin orbit coupling, and it result in a effective magnetic field acting on the spin in the rest frame of the electron. Now, another important thing is that the electron, when they go through the system, they scatter from the walls. So when they are scattered from the walls, this scattering depends on the spin. Depends on the spin-orbit coupling also. That's called, for those of you that are interested, Mott scattering. That's how, there is a Mott polarimeter that's based on it, and it was discussed in 1930, that scattering of electron from surface is, the angular dependence of the scattering is spin dependent. Then the electric field that is acting on the electron going through this is must confine the electron, sorry, must confine the electron to the radius of the molecule. So the electron is going through the system, the electric field of the molecule must confine it to this radius. And then the sign of the electric field depends on the chirality, and the field across the molecules may be affected by its dipole moment, and the sign of the spin that's going through, therefore, depends on the velocity and on the endedness of the molecule. So let's see what happens. Let's assume that we have this spin going down and it's rotating, in this case, clockwise. Then you see basically like a simple think about frisbee when you throw frisbee from a wall. You realize that this rotation will enhance the scattering forwards of this spin. So when the electron's going forwards, you always peak only the forwards scattering. So time reversal is not broken because in general, of course, everything remains the same, but at a certain angle, you give preference for one spin. What happens if you come with the opposite spin? Then this opposite spin will go preferentially in the backwards direction. So at the result, you get that one spin got passed through the system and the other one was back reflected. Interestingly enough, this model can be described by an effective Hamiltonian that looks as if there is magnetic field in the system. And the strength of the magnetic field is basically so that it equal to the force needed to confine the electron within the molecule, namely to the centripetal force of the electron. And as a result, we can get all the calculation and everything comes out nicely. It's important to understand this effective magnetic field is not really an effective magnetic field. It's only nice presentation of the situation. But here comes something which exists in solid-state physics, in quantum Hall effect, and topological insulator, but exists also here. Look what happened. The electron is moving, and the spin is coupled to the linear momentum. Now we have scattering. So the electron cannot go back directly because it will require to flip the spin. But the electron can go around, of course. When the electron is going around, the spin accumulates a phase of pi. Now, because of symmetry, the electron can go the other direction also. Then it accumulates a phase of minus pi. As a result, we get a phase difference of 2 pi between these two paths. A spin wave function changes sign for a phase of 2 pi. So what it means that this path and this path destructively interfere with each other, namely no backscattering. So that's an amazing observation that because of coupling of the linear momentum with the spin, By the Carl system, we don't have efficient backscattering. So now you get an idea why nature perhaps preferred Carl molecules over conjugated molecules, because it makes the electron transmission directional. Electron cannot go back, it's going forwards. Unless you have magnetic impurities, but as long as you don't have magnetic impurities, it will go forward. Okay, so now we want to measure it, to see if the effect exists in biosystem. So we constructed a new type of device. So we have nickel, we have a very thin aluminum oxide layer, and we have a silver layer, on top of which we adsorb DNA with a dye molecule. So what happens? We excite the dye molecule because the dye is excited. Now electron is transferred from the silver to the molecule. We measure the voltage between the silver and the nickel. Now we measure positive voltage. Why? Because we have hole here. Now we magnetize the nickel. If the nickel is magnetized this way, you realize that this spin fits the spin in the silver. So we get electron transfer. However, if we flip, we do the same thing, but now we flip the magnetization. Now electron cannot go through to the silver because it has the wrong spin. So we expect to measure higher voltage. So sure enough, you realize that when you flip the magnetic field, you get higher voltage than in one case versus the other. So using this, we can measure the efficient spin filtering in DNA to do it as a function of temperature and so on. But now we go into a real biological system. And the real biological system, it's photosystem one. Photosystem 1 is part of the photosystem that you probably all know about, and it's quite nice because it absorbs light by energy transfer. The energy is going into the donor unit, which is called P700. This P700 gets excited, and now electron is transferred all the way to the other side where there is iron sulfide a cluster. Amazingly, this distance, it's 7 nanometer. Every electron that starts to move gets to the end. Every electron that starts to move gets to the end. Amazing efficiency. So we decided together with the group of Hanoch and Itai Carmeli from the Tel Aviv University to study the system. They know how to take this complex and to put it on our device. So what happened? Think about it. We put it on our device, so now the donor is close to the silver. When the donor is close to the silver, we excite the donor. Electron is going all the way. If here the P700 gave an electron which is spin polarized, the electron that will be transferred from the silver to the P700 will also be spin polarized. So we will be able to measure it with our device. We can do the opposite way and put this complex on the surface so it's standing on its head. So now we excite the P700, electron is going all the way to the iron sulfide. From the iron sulfide, it will be transferred to the silver. If the electron is spin polarized, of course, it will arrive here spin polarized, and we will be able to measure it. So what we see? Here are the complex, P700 here. The acceptor is here. We excite with light. We expect to get positive voltage. Sure enough, the voltage we measure is positive because electron left the silver to fill the hole in the P700. But now we flip the magnetic field and you see huge effect. Actually, this effect after correction and so on means that all the electrons that left were spin polarized.
But why is the absolute effect small? Means in terms of voltage is just 0.58 to 0.6.
Yeah, or the reason is because there is a temperature effect in the silver. So you have to correct for spin dephasing in the silver, which we did. So then we can put it on the surface in the opposite way, and now electron coming from here will go all the way into the silver. What you get now, negative voltage, you see here, and the spin selectivity again. But please realize now, you see here, with the magnet pointing up, we get high voltage. Here, with the magnet pointing up, we get low voltage. Why is this? Because here, the spin that left was polarized along the velocity of the electron. And the velocity of the electron was from the silver towards outside. So we need this spin polarization to fill the hole. Here, the electron came back, also polarized along the velocity, but this time it's the opposite direction in the laboratory frame, and therefore we have to switch the magnet to the opposite direction. So this basically the story that in photosystem 1, we get 100% spin polarization at room temperature. And the question is it relevant for the functioning of the photosystem 1 as a very efficient electron transfer system? That's we don't have an answer yet. They're taking the same, it's the natural path. We don't apply any voltage.
I understand that.
So it must, it's going, it has one way to go. By the way, I don't show it, this work was published in Angewandte Chemie. So we put donors in different places, like C60 in different places. And you realize that if you put it in the wrong place, then you lose completely the spin selectivity. Okay, now I'm going to tell you, and that's the last part of my talk, about new results that were really, really fresh. It's the first time I'm speaking about. And the idea is spin important in water oxidation? So you know that in the photosystem 2, water gets oxidized to form oxygen. We are not going to study the photosystem 2. It's too complex. What we decided to do is to study artificial system in which people try for many years by now to produce hydrogen by oxidation of water. So what is the idea? The idea is there is an electrochemical cell. There is a catalyst here. And in the solution, we have OH-, 2H- making O2. And here, on the other electrode, we make H2. So that's a four-electron process. So we get 2H- from O2 plus H2. Another H2 is formed on the counter electrode. What is the problem? In the artificial system, the problem is that you have to apply 0.6 volt in order to make this to go. So what people do, you shine light to excite the semiconductor here. But in addition, you have to add 0.6 volt in order to make it to work. And that makes it extremely inefficient. Secondly, the oxidation is not selective to water. So you oxidize everything, which is again a waste. So the question, why it is? So we suggest, as you realize by now, that we are spin-oriented. So we suggest that the problem is the spin. So why the problem is the spin? Okay, what you have here, the electronic configuration of OH-. So this is the electronic configuration, and what happens on the electrode, one spin, Oh, wow. That's okay. What happened on the electrode? One spin is leaving. Okay? So it leaves the oxygen in its atom, in its triplet state. And now two oxygens, each one in a triplet state, have to combine to form the O2 in the triplet state, which is the ground state of the oxygen. However, you realize that if the other oxygen has exactly the same direction alignment as his, that's perfect, because that's two high spin, and they will form the O2 in the triplet state. But there is a probability that what happens after the electron left, the opposite spin left, and now we have another triplet, so the oxygen is still in its ground state, it's triplet, but the relative alignment of the two spin is wrong. So here we form a singlet state. That's really bad. So what can happen? The two oxygen atoms, they are not having the right spin to make the molecule, so they will get very, very close. Only when they are very close, the spins will align by exchange interaction, and they will form the ground state or triplet P. That takes a lot. You have a barrier to bring them together. So our idea was, okay, let's put chiral molecules and force the electron that leaves the OH minus to leave with one well-defined spin. If we do it, we know that in the laboratory frame, the two oxygen atoms will have the spin aligned properly. Okay, so how we do it? First of all, this work was done mainly by Wilbert, who is a postdoc from South Africa, and by Kiran. So basically, we have the following system. We have titanium oxide substrate, we put chiral molecules, we put cadmium selenide nanoparticle here, it's the catalyst. So basically what happened, we excite the cadmium selenide with light. Here we have chiral molecules, so only one spin can go through. It means it leaves here a hole with a well-defined spin, and therefore the OH minus will give only this spin here. So this is the concept. So what you see here, it's the photocurrent that we see in the electrochemical cell. And this is when the molecule, so only to be on the safe side, we did we used several molecules. We took the oligopeptide that you already heard about, and we used two alkyl chains, one very short, C3, and one longer, C11. So look what happened. With C11, we get very inefficient current. C3, it's more, but the oligo, it's much more efficient. But that's not all. What you see here, it's the hydrogen production as function of time. So if we apply 0.7 volt, which is above the threshold, we produce hydrogen with all the three molecules, but clearly with the oligo, we are the most efficient one. But what is even more amazing, if we go to lower voltage of 0.25 volt, there is no hydrogen production with the alkyl molecules, and only with the oligo we get oxygen. So what we show here, that we suggest that the origin of the large overpotential and the non-specificity in the oxidation is because of the need in the regular cells of the two oxygen atoms to be in close proximity. By using the spin selection, we avoid it. And therefore, we can get reaction. It's really a low over potential and much more selective. Now, we make the chiral control system now for making water oxidation closer to the biological system, and because, as you know, in biology, you don't need a overpotential, you all simply use light, that's enough. So here we bring it closer to the biological system. So in summary, I think what I wanted to show you that the chiral molecules is a new material for spintronics. It may explain, although we don't have still the full evidence, we are working on it, the long-range electron transfer in biology through proteins. It may also explain weak magnetic fields effect in biology, and I don't want to elaborate it here unless you will ask. We are able to make spintronic devices with no permanent magnets, which is of highly technical importance. The devices that we are make are temperature independent and size independent. So basically, our effect doesn't depend on temperature and does not depend on the size. Single molecule can show it. So we remove two major constraints on spintronic devices. So in addition, as I just described, we have a new insight on catalysis of multiple electron reactions, and perhaps the spin, the ability to control spin, allows to make much more efficient catalysis reaction. And this is my group. Shinto did this work on the spintronic devices that I mentioned. Kiran is using the AFM and working now on force-dependent spin transmission through chiral molecules. Deb did work on the electrochemistry. Prakash did the polymer work. Hila did some work that I didn't describe here on bacterial rhodopsin, very interesting. And Wilbert did some their work on the hydrogen, and that was done together with Nirit. And thank you. Of what?
Extended conjugation. There is no conjugation.
Right.
So what is the path of the electron as it's going from one end to the other end? Is it tunneling or is it going through the single bonds?
Okay. So in polyalanine, it's clearly tunneling. It's about 2 nanometer, and I think it's clearly that. In DNA, it's a big question what happened in DNA, because it's a long-range electron transfer, and typically, people say it's hopping. Actually, the argument against hopping, because the current that people see is too high to support hopping. So now there are models about resonance electron transfer, and I don't want to get into it. But from my point of view, I think it doesn't really matter what is the mechanism, as long as the spin coherency or the spin coherent lifetime is longer than the conduction time. We have result, of course, I didn't show them because they are all negative, that in the case that we have a lot of scattering in the system, we lose completely the spin selectivity. So like a chiral conductive polymer, we can change the thickness, and clearly, once you get scattering, you lose completely the spin selectivity. So I don't think the issue is really what is the conduction mechanism, but what is the conduction time versus the spin lifetime.
So one related question. So because proteins are polypeptides, you can change the helicity on the pitch.
Yeah.
So does that affect your...
Yeah. So we have results by atomic force microscope where we can push the molecule, and I didn't show it because we didn't finish all the calibration and so on, but when we push the molecule, we clearly see that we increase the current, but we reduce the spin selectivity. And we have other results when we denaturate, that's we publish, when we denaturate the peptides, we lose the spin selectivity. So clearly there is clear relation between the secondary structure, it's not only the primary structure, the secondary structure and the spin selectivity.
Yeah, very nice and exciting talk, especially the last part. I just had an observation. So the thing that you were mentioning about the OH minus fundamentally is not paramagnetic. So that one unpaired electron that you showed is not going to be there. So you would have to take out as an OH dot, and then the OH dot, then you pull up one more electron because you have to have four electrons that have to be removed.
Right.
So initially you do this for all sorts of systems that you are explaining. It's basically the solid state system.
Right.
In the molecular system, in the molecular catalyst, you already have the water bound to metals which are coupled through the bond, through some ligand. So in the extended systems, you have one site for water, two sites for water, hydroxide binding, and then you can explain this mechanism by saying that, there is a possibility of a triplet here and a triplet here after two bond electron oxidations on each site. And then you would like to couple whether this is this way or this way. There is the difference.
Right.
That's what you're pointing out.
Right.
But in the molecular versions...
What do you mean molecular versions?
In the sense that you have a molecular catalyst rather than hematite, which is an extended system, where you have specific binding sites for the water molecule. Now, these two sites will be coupled by anti-ferromagnetic coupling or some form of coupling within the metal ions. Under those conditions, you won't see the selectivity. Is that correct?
Yeah, of course. If you have exchange interaction,
the exchange
interaction will control it.
Yes.
The point is that exchange interaction is a very short-range force. The exchange is very short range. From all interactions you have, it's the shortest one. And as a result, if it exists, then it's strong. But if you want to have large cross section for reaction, you want to work beyond the distance of the exchange, then you get larger cross section. No, okay. What it really matter is how what you want the two O atoms to be so that their spin relative to the laboratory frame will be aligned about parallel.
No, I'm not talking about the oxygen one. In your magnetoresistor.
Yeah. How it depends on the direction. Okay, good question. Yeah, it does depend. In principle, you basically, as I showed, it depends on the length. So if the molecule lying, you have less length.
That's all. There is no. So it's just the length that is less when it is lying.
Yeah, it's the chirality. You see, the nice about chirality, it doesn't matter how you look on it; it's always the same chirality. But when it's lying, then you have very little. Chiral region. When it's standing, you have longer.
The other question I had, in the end you mentioned that this temperature independent, but what do you mean by that? For example, you would expect if I go lower in temperature, your magnetoresistance would increase.
No. Okay, it's not. Okay, there are two issues. In the case of the spin valve, there is the effect on the nickel. So if you want, I can show you the details, but indeed you see the hysteresis in the nickel increases as a function of temperature. But the absolute magnitude of the magnetoresistance doesn't change. So as long as the nickel is magnetized, and with this field it was completely saturated, then it's temperature independent. If you don't reach saturation in the nickel, then simply you don't measure it because the nickel is not a good measure. But the effect itself is temperature independent. Yeah.
You were talking about the Mott polarimetry.
Yeah.
How do you do it in the condensed phase? How are you doing that?
No, we don't do it. No, what I'm saying, okay, so let's distinguish. We use Mott polarimeter for the photoemission studies. Then you have electron in vacuum. Regarding our mechanism, it's basically multiple scattering inside the solid. So I mention the Mott only as an indication for the scattering, anisotropy of the scattering as function of the spin. That's all. Yeah.
You can only flip the one of the spins of one oxygen atom to create a triplet.
Again?
If you flip the spins of the other oxygen atoms.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Then you're going to end up in a singlet, which is excited.
Right.
So all you need to just spin, flip the one spin. So how do you get that control?
You can't. And I tell you why. It costs you a lot of energy. Because that's basically, you know that we have a Hund's rule that tells you that the system wants to be in the high spin. If you want to go to one, if you flip one spin, then you go to higher energy state. So you pay an energy for it.
Yeah, but if you have the two oxygen atoms with the opposite spins, and
there are two issues here. One, what happened in the single atom? In the single atom, you will go always for the high spin. Now you can have high spin here and high spin here, and they can be now either parallel or anti-parallel. That's the only possibility you have. So if they are parallel, you are on very high spin surface, and therefore you can form the triplet state easily. If they are opposite aligned, then you are on the singlet surface, then there is no way you can form high spin state unless you have inter-system crossing, but that's different.
Yeah,
you form the singlet excited state. Yeah, that costs you 1 EV. That's very inefficient.
More questions? Well, I have a very
Layers that you deposit, is it chemically or through evaporation?
We do it chemically, but aluminum oxide, of course, it's evaporation. In the case of the polymer, it's physisolved. So it doesn't matter really so much. Of course, what's nice about the chemically that you get nice orientation, so it's very condensed and so on.
Spin can also be part of the triplet manifold, T0 state, for example.
Ah, that's so very, yeah.
Statistically, you get 25% reactive, 75% not reactive.
Yeah, so you're right. However, and that's really interesting issue, and it's very delicate issue, but it's very interesting. It's true, you can have opposite spin, one of the spin state, of the triplet spin state, it's alpha, beta, plus beta, alpha. It still required angular momentum of spin, despite that it's alpha, beta, plus beta, alpha, because of the coincidence, you have angular momentum. So if you start with two angular momentum states that cancel each other, you cannot form, that's something very tricky, you cannot form this triplet state. Because you have to conserve the total angular momentum. And the total angular momentum system in the laboratory frame is zero. So if you like, that's something that we are going to use this for spin OLEDs. And the same question came there. And it's really interesting to find that you, if you start with at zero spin, you can't form the triplet zero spin, triplet alpha beta plus beta alpha. Because there are two issues, the orientation of spin and the total spin angular momentum.
Rifle effect.
No, the rifle effect pretty much.